This CLE course is based on the New York State appellate decisions that were released in April of 2019 and dealt with issues related to civil procedure. The summaries of those decisions were posted weekly on the New York Appellate Digest website, and they have been compiled into an update pamphlet. And it's that April 2019 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this CLE course, and the pamphlet is available on the New York Appellate Digest website. So the first case in the 2019 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet that we're going to discuss is LDIR LLC on page 5. It deals with a motion to amend a complaint in a contractual dispute, and the essence of the holding is that if the contract is ambiguous, that's not an issue that should be addressed at the motion to dismiss stage. The First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Richter, over a partial dissent, held plaintiffs, in this case it was the trustees, motion to amend its complaint in these residential mortgage-backed securities actions should have been granted. The amendment sought to allege defendant breached the underlying contract by failing to notify the trustee of loan breaches. The majority found that the contract provision requiring notice was ambiguous, and the dissent had argued that the contract was not ambiguous and did not require notification. The court said the motion court should have granted the trustees' motions for leave to file the amended complaints with respect to the express breach of contract claims. It cannot be said at this early stage of the proceedings that these claims are palpably improper or insufficient as a matter of law. Because the disputed provision is reasonably susceptible to more than one interpretation, it cannot be construed as a matter of law, and dismissal is not appropriate. Next is Mirdita, M-I-R-D-I-T-A, on page 6. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff could not defeat a summary judgment motion by raising a new theory of liability in the opposing papers. The court said, plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact. Her expert failed to address the theories of liability raised in the complaint and bill of particulars and failed to rebut defendant's showing. Instead, plaintiff's expert raised a new theory about the cause of plaintiff's injuries from smoke inhalation. The court went on to say, a plaintiff cannot defeat a summary judgment motion by asserting a new theory of liability for the first time in opposition papers. Next is the Baptiste case, which is on page 7. It deals with two issues, the admissibility of depositions and the consideration of evidence that's submitted for the first time in the reply papers. The Second Department, although affirming the denial of defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case on other grounds, noted that the depositions were admissible and evidence submitted in reply should have been considered. The court said, although the plaintiff's deposition transcript, which the defendant submitted in support of their motion, was unsigned, it was nonetheless admissible as the plaintiff raised no objection to its submission or accuracy and in fact requested that the Supreme Court incorporate his transcript into his opposition. Regarding the deposition transcript of decedent's niece, which the defendants also submitted in support of their motion, the defendants demonstrated that they had submitted the unsigned transcript to the decedent's niece for review, but that she failed to sign and return it within 60 days. Therefore, the niece's deposition transcript could have been used by the defendants as fully as though signed. And it cites CPLR 3116A. The court went on, even though the evidence demonstrating The defendant's compliance with CPLR 3116A was submitted by the defendants in reply. The court should have considered it because it was in direct response to allegations raised for the first time in plaintiff's opposition papers. And finally, the court said the unsigned deposition transcript of the defendant's property manager was admissible under CPLR 3116A because it was submitted by the defendants themselves and was therefore adopted as accurate. Next is Rozanski on pages 7 and 8, Second Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that defendant drivers, that's Rozanski's, medical condition at the time of this 2004 traffic accident was not in controversy, and therefore the driver's medical records were not discoverable. Rozanski, who subsequently died, had in 2006 submitted a letter from his social worker to plaintiff's attorney claiming he suffered from dementia, anxiety, and depression, allegedly to be excused from a deposition. But otherwise, the issue of Rozanski's health was not raised. The court wrote, the plaintiffs failed to sustain their initial burden of demonstrating that Rozanski's condition at the time of the accident was in controversy within the meaning of CPLR 3121A. Even if the plaintiffs had met that burden, neither Rozanski nor his estate waived the privilege attached to the medical records, as the defendant has not asserted a counterclaim or sought to excuse Rozanski's conduct at the time of the accident on the basis of some condition. Contrary to the conclusion of our dissenting colleagues, Rozanski did not place his mental condition at the time of the accident in controversy or waive the privilege attached to his medical records by allegedly declining to be deposed. Neither Rozanski nor his estate have sought to excuse his conduct at the time of the accident due to any condition. At best, Rozanski placed his mental condition in September 2006 at issue by allegedly refusing to appear for a deposition. The plaintiffs could have moved at that time to compel the deposition and challenged the social worker's diagnosis. Instead, 9 years after the social worker's letter and 6 years after Rozanski's death and after filing 3 notes of issue over the course of some 7 years, indicating that discovery was complete and the case was ready for trial, the plaintiffs purported to use the mechanism of a trial subpoena to compel production of Rozanski's medical records from 1999 to the present. So that attempt was properly denied. Next is the Sanders case on pages 8 and 9. It has to do with discovery and spoliation, as well as the presumption of mailing. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the plaintiff was not entitled to the presumption of receipt with respect to a letter alleged to have been sent to the defendant requesting surveillance video from 6 hours before to 2 hours after plaintiff's slip and fall. Only a 2-minute clip showing plaintiff's fall had been preserved, and Supreme Court had precluded the defendant from presenting video evidence as a sanction for spoliation pursuant to CPLR 3126. The court wrote, the plaintiff did not establish that the defendant failed to preserve all of the surveillance video footage taken on the date of the accident. The letter dated February 23, 2016, which was submitted for the first time with plaintiff's reply papers, may be considered since the defendant had an opportunity to respond and submit papers in surreply. However, the defendant denied receiving this letter, and we reject the plaintiff's argument that he is entitled to the presumption of receipt. The mere assertion in the reply affirmation of plaintiff's attorney that the letter dated February 23, 2016 was sent to the defendant, unsupported by someone with personal knowledge of the mailing of the letter, or proof of standard office practice or procedure designed to ensure that the letter was properly addressed and mailed, was insufficient to give rise to the presumption of receipt that attaches to letters duly addressed and mailed. Therefore, the spoliation sanction was not appropriate in that case. Next is Matter of Brooks on pages 9 and 10, a family law case which deals with the issue of choice of law. The Fourth Department, reversing family court, held that despite the choice of law provision in the separation agreement, New York law applied to any modification of child support. The family lived in New Jersey when the separation agreement, providing that New Jersey law would control support modification, was executed, but all parties were living in New York when the application for modification was made. The court wrote, "We conclude that the court had jurisdiction pursuant to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, that's UIFSA, to resolve the issues raised in the mother's petition and objections. The UIFSA unequivocally provides that whereas here the parents reside in this state and the child does not reside in the issuing state, a tribunal of this state has jurisdiction to enforce and to modify the issuing state's child support order in a proceeding to register that order. We agree with the mother that New York law must be applied to determine the father's child support obligation, inasmuch as the statute further provides that a tribunal of this state exercising jurisdiction under this section shall apply the procedural and substantive law of this state to the proceeding for enforcement or modification." And it's citing Family Court Act Section 580-613, Subdivision B. The court went on, "Although courts will generally enforce a choice of law clause, so long as the chosen law bears a reasonable relationship to the parties or the transaction, courts will not enforce such clauses where the chosen law violates some fundamental principle of justice, some prevalent conception of good morals, some deep-rooted tradition of the common weal. It is long settled that New York has a strong public policy that obligates a parent to support his or her child. Under New York law, child support obligations are required to be calculated pursuant to the Child Support Standards Act, that's the CSSA, and the duty of a parent to support his or her child shall not be eliminated or diminished by the terms of a separation agreement. In addition, whereas New Jersey law provides that child support obligations generally end when a child reaches the age of 19, in New York, a parent's duties to support his or her child until the child reaches the age of 21 years is a matter of fundamental public policy. Under the circumstances, and given that the parties do not have a valid agreement to opt out of the CSSA, we conclude that enforcement of the party's choice of law provision would violate those strong New York public policies." Next is Matter of Neems on pages 10 and 11, another family law case dealing with the issue of subject matter jurisdiction. The Fourth Department, in a full opinion by Justice Nemoyer, reversing family court, held that New York did not have subject matter jurisdiction over a child custody proceeding. At the time the proceeding was brought, the child had not lived in New York for 6 months, and New Jersey still had jurisdiction. The court wrote, "New Jersey retained continuing jurisdiction of this matter until January 15, 2016, that being 6 months after the child's alleged move to New York, and 1 week after the instant proceeding was commenced on January 8, 2016. New York lacked jurisdiction under Domestic Relations Law 76-1D, because New Jersey could have exercised jurisdiction on the date this proceeding was commenced in New York. Next is the Shaw case on pages 11, 12, and 12. It's another family law case. It deals with a postnuptial agreement. Second Department, modifying Supreme Court, dealt with the analytical criteria for motions to dismiss counterclaims and affirmative defenses in the context of a postnuptial agreement, which was alleged to have been tainted by fraud, coercion, duress, and unconscionability. The unconscionable allegations survived the motion to dismiss, and the decision covers all of those substantive and procedural issues in some depth. The court wrote, "At this stage of the action, the defendant's pleadings, as amplified by his submissions in opposition to plaintiff's motion and in support of his cross motion, are sufficient to allege both procedural and substantive unconscionability. So although the case is too complex to summarize here, it has substantive discussions of the pleading requirements for fraud, coercion, duress, and unconscionability in the context of a contract, here a postnuptial agreement. Next case is JBB NY LLC on pages 12 and 13. It has to do with the effect of being served with a notice through the New York State Court's electronic filing system. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that a notice of entry in this foreclosure action, although the New York State Court's electronic filing system was used, was not properly served, and therefore defendant's time to answer never started running, and defendants were not in default. Another party in this action was actually served with a hard copy of the notice of entry, but the particular defendants in this aspect of the action were only served with the notification of that hard copy service through the New York State Court's electronic filing system. And under the rule, the applicable rule, which is 22 NYCRR 202.5-B, subdivisions H2, simply getting notification that another party was served, getting that notification through the New York State Court's electronic filing site is not sufficient. There's a specific exception in that rule. I'll just read the rule, that section. Subdivision H2, which appears in a subsection entitled Entry of Orders and Judgments and Notice of Entry, provides in relevant part, a party may serve an order or judgment and written notice of its entry electronically by filing them with the New York State Court's electronic filing site and causing transmission by the site of notification of receipt of the documents which shall constitute service by the filer. In the alternative, a party may serve a copy of the order or judgment and written notice of its entry in hard copy by any method set forth in CPLR 2103B, subdivisions 1 through 6. If service is made in hard copy by any such method, and a copy of the order or judgment and notice of its entry and proof of such hard copy service are thereafter filed with the New York State Court electronic filing site, transmission by the New York State Court electronic filing site of notification of receipt of those documents shall not constitute additional service of the notice of entry on the parties to whom the notification was sent. So again here, another party, not these particular defendants, was served with a hard copy of the notice of entry, and then the defendants in this case were only notified of that service through the New York Court's electronic filing site, and under this particular exception to the rule, that notice did not constitute service on these defendants. Therefore, the time for answering never started to run for them, and they were not in default. So in a nutshell, simply being notified through the New York Court's electronic filing system that another party was served with a hard copy of a document does not constitute service. Next is the Bank of America case on page 13. It's a foreclosure action. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the denial of defendant's motion to vacate a default did not preclude defendant's motion to dismiss the foreclosure action based upon the plaintiff bank's failure to comply with a local rule. Here it's Rule 8. The rule is from the Kings County Supreme Court Uniform Civil Rules. The court said, Rule 8 requires a plaintiff in a foreclosure action to file a motion for a judgment of foreclosure within 1 year of entry of the order of reference. Contrary to the Supreme Court's determination, the defendant was not precluded from seeking relief under Rule 8 by the denial of that branch of his motion, which was to vacate his default. So again, although the defendant's motion to vacate his default was denied, the action was dismissed because the bank did not comply with that rule requiring that a motion for a judgment of foreclosure be filed within 1 year of the entry of the order of reference. Next is the Chase Home Finance case on page 13. It's another foreclosure action, and it simply holds that the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed the complaint without giving the plaintiff bank the opportunity to be heard. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed the complaint as abandoned without giving plaintiff a chance to be heard. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court's sua sponte determination to direct dismissal of the complaint deprived the plaintiff of notice and opportunity to be heard and amounted to a denial of plaintiff's due process rights," citing CPLR 3216. The court should have granted that branch of plaintiff's motion, which was to vacate the order which dismissed the complaint. That was the sua sponte order. Next is the City Mortgage case on pages 14 and 15, another foreclosure action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the court was without power to dismiss for neglect to prosecute because the preconditions in CPLR 3216 were not met. Supreme Court dismissed the complaint in this foreclosure action, finding that plaintiff bank had not complied with an oral directive issued at the status conference. The court wrote, "A court may not dismiss an action based on neglect to prosecute unless the statutory preconditions to dismissal as articulated in CPLR 3216 are met. Specifically, issue must have been joined. At least 1 year must have elapsed since joinder of issue. The defendant or the court must have served on the plaintiff a written demand to serve and file a note of issue within 90 days, and the plaintiff must have failed to serve and file a note of issue within the 90-day period." Here, Supreme Court was without power to direct dismissal of the action on the ground of failure to prosecute because the plaintiff was not served with a written demand to serve and file a note of issue within 90 days. Next is LNV Corporation. It's on pages 15 and 16, another foreclosure action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff did not demonstrate it had complied with the notice requirements of Real Property Action and Proceedings Law, Section 1304. The court noted that evidence submitted in reply was properly considered because the opposing party had had an opportunity to respond to it. The court wrote, "Here, even considering the affidavit of Victoria Bressner submitted by the plaintiff for the first time in opposition to the defendant's cross motion, the plaintiff failed to establish strict compliance with Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304. Bressner did not have personal knowledge of the purported mailing and did not make the requisite showing that she was familiar with the plaintiff's mailing practices and procedures to establish proof of a standard office practice and procedure designed to ensure that items are properly addressed and mailed. In addition, the record indicates that the notices were not mailed by the plaintiff." This issue comes up a lot in foreclosure cases. The statutory proof requirements for mailing are often not met by the bank. Next is the Brennan case on page 16. It has to do with the pleading requirements for a fraud cause of action. Apparently the complaint alleged a constructive fraud cause of action and a fraud cause of action, and the court noted that the CPLR's strict requirements or higher pleading requirements for fraud were not met. However, the lower pleading requirements for constructive fraud had been met in this case. The action alleged members of Defendant Limited Liability Company fraudulently transferred funds from the LLC to the defendant members and rendered the LLC insolvent. The First Department held that the constructive fraud cause of action was sufficiently pled, but the allegations did not support an actual fraud cause of action. The court said, the complaint implicitly alleges that a necessary element of fair consideration, that being good faith, was lacking when the transfers were made. However, the complaint fails to state a cause of action for actual fraud under debtor and creditor law sections 276 and 276A. Unlike the allegations supporting the constructive fraud claim, the allegations supporting the actual fraud claim are subject to the heightened pleading standard of CPLR 3016B. And the allegations about fair consideration do not meet that standard because they were made upon information and belief, and the source of the information was not disclosed. Nor does the complaint allege any other badges of fraud. So again, the heightened pleading requirements of CPLR 3016B were required to allege actual fraud, and those heightened pleading requirements were not met. Next is the Betts case on page 17. It's another case where the sua sponte action of a judge was not authorized. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the judge did not have the authority to vacate a default judgment in the absence of a request for that relief. The First Department treated the notice of appeal as a motion for leave to appeal, noting that a sua sponte order is not appealable as of right. The court said, while an order entered sua sponte is not appealable as of right, given the lack of evidence of the timeliness of the service of the answer and given the motion court's failure to identify a legal basis for vacating the prior order, we deem the notice of appeal a motion for leave to appeal, and we grant leave. The court exceeded its authority in sua sponte vacating the prior order granting plaintiff's motion for a default judgment. In the absence of a motion or other request for relief from that order, the court's discretion to correct the order was limited to curing any mistake, defect, or irregularity, not affecting a substantial right of the party. So this case is another example of the court lacking the power to rule on an issue that was not raised by the parties. Next is the Sadowski case on pages 17 and 18. It's another sua sponte case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed the case for neglect to prosecute in the absence of the prerequisites mandated by CPLR 3216. So this is another case where a dismissal was granted by a judge in the absence of the prerequisites laid out by CPLR 3216. I'll just read through what the court says to reiterate what those prerequisites are. A court may not dismiss an action based on neglect to prosecute unless the statutory preconditions to dismissal as articulated in CPLR 3216 are met. Effective January 1, 2015, the legislature amended in several significant respects the statutory preconditions to dismissal under CPLR 3216. One such precondition is that whereas here a written demand to resume prosecution of the action is made by the court, the demand shall set forth the specific conduct constituting the neglect, which conduct shall demonstrate a general pattern of delay in proceeding with the litigation. Here, the certification order did not set forth any specific conduct constituting neglect by the plaintiff. Additionally, before issuing an order dismissing the case based on a party's failure to comply with the 90-day demand, the court must give the party notice so that the party has an opportunity to show a justifiable excuse for the delay and a good and meritorious cause of action. Supreme Court failed to give the parties notice and an opportunity to be heard prior to, in effect, directing dismissal of the action pursuant to CPLR 3216. The next case, which is Marinello on page 18, is another example of a sua sponte dismissal in the absence of the prerequisites laid out in CPLR 3216. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed the complaint for neglect to prosecute without following the procedure required by CPLR 3216. And then the court explained what those procedures are. A court cannot dismiss an action sua sponte pursuant to CPLR 3216A unless the conditions set forth in CPLR 3216B have been met, including the requirement that the court or party seeking relief shall have served a written demand requiring the party against whom such relief is sought to resume prosecution of the action and to serve and file a note of issue within 90 days after the receipt of the demand, and further stating that the default by the party upon whom such notice is served in complying with such demand within the said 90-day period will serve as a basis for a motion by the party serving said demand for dismissal as against him or her for unreasonably neglecting to proceed. That's CPLR 3216B3. Moreover, the court should not have administratively dismissed the amended complaint without further notice to the parties. Next is the Fishon case, which is on page 19. It deals with an improper motion for judgment as a matter of law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's motion to strike defendant's answer on spoliation grounds in this medical malpractice and wrongful death action made during jury selection should not have been granted. It was not a proper motion for a judgment as a matter of law pursuant to CPLR 4401, and the ruling violated the law of the case. The court wrote, during jury selection, the plaintiff made an oral application to strike the defendant's answer and for judgment as a matter of law on the issue of liability based on the defendant's alleged spoliation of evidence relating to certain telemetry strips and the defendant's failure to perform an autopsy on the decedent. A motion for summary judgment as a matter of law is to be made at the close of an opposing party's case or at any time on the basis of admissions, citing CPLR 4401. And the grant of such a motion prior to the close of the opposing party's case generally will be reversed as premature, even if the ultimate success of the opposing party in the action is improbable. Here, plaintiff's oral application, which was made during jury selection, was not based on any admissions by the defendant, and Supreme Court should not have considered the merits of the plaintiff's application at that juncture. The court went on to discuss the law of the case issue. The doctrine of the law of the case is a rule of practice, an articulation of sound policy that, when an issue is once judicially determined, that it should be the end of the matter as far as judges and courts of coordinate jurisdiction are concerned. The doctrine forecloses reexamination of an issue previously determined by a court of coordinate jurisdiction, absent a showing of newly discovered evidence or a change in the law. Here, Supreme Court violated the doctrine of the law of the case by disregarding the prior order denying that branch of the plaintiff's earlier motion, which was to strike the defendant's answer based upon the same evidentiary issues. So the issues raised in the motion for a judgment as a matter of law had been raised before and had been determined before and became the law of the case. Next is the Hertz case on page 19. It deals with the concept of law office failure as an excuse. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that law office failure was a legitimate excuse for failing to serve an answer in this case. Defendant had made a pre-answer motion to dismiss and thereby demonstrated that the defendant did not intend to abandon the action. The court wrote, defendant satisfied the requirements of CPLR 3012D, which authorizes an extension of time to appear or plead upon such terms as may be just and upon a showing of a reasonable excuse for delay or default. The delay in filing an answer was occasioned by law office failure, which can constitute a reasonable excuse. Defendant's counsel explained that its failure to file its answer was due to an error in its office's case management system, which, upon the entry of a pre-answer motion to dismiss, marked the complaint answered. Service of the pre-answer motion to dismiss revealed defendants did not intend to abandon the action. Plaintiff does not argue that it has been prejudiced as a result of the defendant's 3-month delay, and our determination comports with New York's strong public policy in favor of litigating matters on the merits. Next is the Caymans case on pages 20 and 21. The concept here is whether a statute gives rise to a private right of action. Second Department held that New York's mental health parity law, which is called Timothy's Law, and its insurance law 3221 and 4303, did not create a private right of action over and above the administrative enforcement provisions. Plaintiff alleged the health insurance benefits administered by the defendants were far more restrictive for mental health than for general medical claims. The court wrote, "The Court of Appeals has held that regardless of its consistency with the basic legislative goal, a private right of action should not be judicially sanctioned if it is incompatible with the enforcement mechanism chosen by the legislature or with some other aspect of the overall statutory scheme. Thus, where the legislature clearly contemplated administrative enforcement of the statute, the question then becomes whether, in addition to administrative enforcement, an implied right of action would be consistent with the legislative scheme. Determinations of whether the law had been violated require complex fact-based determinations about medical necessity, and the New York State Department of Financial Services had implemented a comprehensive system to evaluate appeals following denials of coverage. Allowing people to litigate these issues in court might yield duplicative or inconsistent results." So Timothy's Law or Insurance Law 3221 and 4303 do not give rise to a private right of action. Next is the Deb case on page 21. It just clarifies the burden of proof when demonstrating a person was properly served. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint because defendant was not timely served should have been granted. The defendant was ambivalent about when he was served, and the motion was denied on that ground. However, it's the plaintiff's burden to prove when service was made. The court wrote, "The burden of proving that personal jurisdiction was acquired over a defendant rests with the plaintiff. Although the failure to file an affidavit of service with the court is generally a procedural irregularity which may be cured, in this case, the plaintiff did not cure the defect. In the absence of evidence that the appellant was properly served, that branch of defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint, insofar as asserted against the appellant, for lack of personal jurisdiction, should have been granted." Next is the Biro or Biro case on page 22. It's a statute of limitations case in a defamation action. The First Department held that a hyperlink in an email to an allegedly defamatory article is not a republication of the article, which would start the statute of limitations running again. The defamation action was therefore time barred. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this CLE, which is based on the update pamphlet, which includes New York State appellate decisions released in the month of April 2019 and which deal with civil procedure. The verification code for this April 2019 civil procedure CLE course is foreclosure. Again, the verification code for this April 2019 civil procedure update CLE course is foreclosure. The final case in this CLE course is on pages 22 and 23. It's the ARMA case. It has to do with the information that a youthful offender must provide to a court in a civil action against the youthful offender. The Second Department held that the defendant's youthful offender adjudication allows the defendant to refuse to answer questions about the charges, the police investigation, whether she pled guilty, and whether a youthful offender adjudication was made, but the defendant cannot refuse to answer questions about the facts underlying the adjudication. Here, plaintiff sued defendant for personal injuries stemming from a fight with the defendant, which was the basis for the youthful offender adjudication. So again, the underlying facts are fair game in a lawsuit against the youthful offender, but the youthful offender need not answer questions about the charges, the investigation, whether she pled guilty, and whether a youthful offender adjudication was made. That concludes this CLE course based on the summaries of New York State appellate decisions dealing with civil procedure that were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in April of 2019 and were thereafter compiled in the April 2019 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet.